dressed in red. Looks like the band that Moses led.
You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. I'm Devo Dykes.
And I'm David Dykes.
And before we begin session four of our podcast series, The Role of the Public Intellectual in Just Society, featuring Sister Joan Chittister, an American Benedictine nun, author, and lecturer from Erie, Pennsylvania, I'd like to bring attention to our opening music. Wade Through the Water, an African-American Jubilee song from 1901, is sung by Ann Phelps, a dear friend and colleague, and currently Director of Programming for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest University. Ann performs with Theodicy Jazz Collective, a group of musicians committed to ministry through the creative spiritual power of music. The collective has a unique sound that's influenced by the spirituals and gospel music of the African American church, as well as progressive jazz and world music. Their music is available on Amazon, Spotify, Apple Music, and most listening platforms. And we are honored that Theodicy Jazz Collective and Ann Phelps have given us permission to use their music. If you're interested, please search online for Theodicy Jazz Collective and explore their newest releases. You won't be disappointed. Now, session four is titled The Public Intellectual and the Next Generation.
Before we go any further, let's identify some contemporary public intellectuals. Thinking of Karen Armstrong, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Paul Krugman, John Meacham, Maya Angelou, and Jane Goodall. That ought to kind of put us in a frame of thinking. But this is an important point to make. These are all well-recognized public intellectuals, and I kind of wanted to give that that frame to you to put that concept into. But I want to make the point that what Joan Chittister is making an argument for is that if we want society to be bent toward the common good, then we need, as involved, caring people, we need to be public intellectuals. And by that, she means we take it seriously, we study, we review, we talk with others about what is reasonable and what needs to be brought to the front. And I think Joan would say the most important thing for the public intellectual is to raise her or his thought on what needs to be done for the common good. Does that work all right?
Yes, yes.
I'm going to review the first four that she identified in the third session. First, public intellectuals in a country that protect freedom of speech have the obligation to make the invisible visible. Secondly, public intellectuals who are not fettered by institutional boundaries set out to include the public in what otherwise would be closed to them. Third, Joan says that public intellectuals are often kind of vilified and told that they're preaching to the choir. Actually, public intellectuals bring living proof of the public heart by giving it light and by exposing the size of the choir and the strength of its voice and the direction of the wind in which it's moving. And finally, the public intellectual brings community commitment to what is already here, but smoldering underground, waiting for someone to speak its name.
Well, those are the first four. And so in session four today, we're going to be addressing the next four characteristics that Sister Joan talks about. So we're going to learn about the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, and the eight ways that public intellectuals strengthen the quality and character of a just democracy. So let's listen to Joan's first quote.
Five, it's public intellectuals who maintain the spirit of the young and the restless avant-garde. They keep society spurred. They make sure that the new ideas are listened to. They make sure that they listen and they hear their grandchildren and their concerns. They press the juice out of the old ideas and they heat up the new ones that keep a society moving. In our own time, in our time, most of the lifetime of people here, it's been public intellectuals, not officials. It was the Berrigans and the Fredans and the Martin Luther Kings and the Maya Angelous and the Dorothy Days and the Bishop Morrises and the Roy Bourgeois who brought light to the civil rights movement, light to the farm workers in the field, light to the undocumented, light to the routine beating of women and the sexual abuse of children, light to the baptisms and bat mitzvahs, as well as to the needs of women. They prodded us. They moved those institutions. They pushed against their walls, and they said, we're ready and we want this discussed. And you see now, in this very election, it is young people who are calling for things that we say we cannot accept and won't do, but we will if they keep there. If they say this is an old, dead agenda, this doesn't work. It's the young people who don't see the colors anymore that we see, who don't buy into denominational divisions. They aren't tearing us apart. They're making us a new world.
Joan's primary point in this last quotation has been to make us aware that public intellectuals, that's all of us who take this seriously and work at it, that we need to be very focused on recruiting members of the next generation.
Right.
Here's the good news. We've got a lot of good stuff to work with, because this next generation that's coming on now, they don't buy any of our old issues. Liberal, conservative, black and white, gay and straight. Those divisions just don't interest them. They don't think they're important, which we've been waiting for that to happen in human society for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So Joan expects public intellectuals, no matter how small our voice is, will take on responsibility for nurturing this next generation. And by that, I don't mean telling them what to think or do, but asking them about it, drawing them into that conversation.
Well, and also this young generation are so astute, and I think that they are looking back at historically of intellectuals from previous centuries and then current intellectuals, and I think that they're taking a lot of that information in. Sister Joan mentions Dr. Maya Angelou as one of the remarkable public intellectuals of our time, and Dr. Angelou was an acclaimed American poet, a storyteller, a civil rights activist, a singer, a dancer, an actress, a composer, and actually Hollywood's first female black director. But she is most famous for her writing and especially her poetry. And I just want to mention my favorite phrase from Dr. Angelou. She says, I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. I took a moment to reflect on that, to, you know, just check out my memory. And she's right. I may not remember the details, but I definitely remember how I felt. the embarrassment, the humiliation. And this was by someone in my own family and someone that I loved and admired. And today, who I have very little contact with, and it was the memory of how I felt during that experience that has stayed with me all of these years. And so I think that's an important recognition that Dr. Angelou has, and I think that our public intellectuals have all experienced at some level great hardships in life.
I would not be surprised, because when I read what they write or hear what they speak, they sound like they've got a sense of wisdom. They've had a lot of experiences, and public intellectuals are like everybody else in the sense that they've got their issues to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in your case, you can't fix how that person made you feel,
mm-hmm.
but you can do something else about it.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, let's listen to Sister Joan's second audio clip.
Finally, public intellectuals seed, in other words, social change. They're the carriers of yesterday's wisdom, yes, but they're also the banner bearers of tomorrow's questions. And for the most part, they have to go on alone for a long time. They don't get institutional encouragement. They get even less institutional help. They depend on you. They depend on your willingness to at least listen to the ideas. They depend on the courage it takes to offer an idea that nobody wants to hear.
In this sixth characteristic of public intellectuals that Joan has been describing, she says that public intellectuals seed social change.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily aren't able to make it, but they can certainly be part of seeding that and letting others grow with it and take it to where it needs to be. One of the reasons that we as individuals should take up this same cause is because the public intellectuals typically do not get institutional support. In fact, most often, they're getting support that says, don't talk about this. Just don't raise that issue. Things are going to be okay. So just hear what I'm saying. To ask a question about an institution or an establishment codes to a lot of people that you're wanting to cause trouble, that you can't just leave something alone. And people who have an investment in that don't want us to ask questions. They do not want us to raise these in the public square.
Well, and it's you're inviting change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we deal with that, I guess, so often throughout history. You've got this great resistance in our populace that they are not willing to make change, and change is inevitable. We are going to experience change. And I'm puzzled why people insist on fighting change.
Well, if you really want to know, of course, you have to ask them. But I don't think we're far off the mark when we say, if you listen to what they say and watch their behavior, I don't know what else they're telling us, but they're telling us this isn't working for me. So as exasperated as we get with the no-sayers and the people that just want to raise hell about it all, we need, as public intellectuals, to stop and consider what brought these people to this place in their lives. And we need to look at that.
Well, and what's so current is the issue over the insurrection.
Yes.
And what triggered, what was the source? Why did these individuals resist change, and why did these individuals demand that change not be made? Why, what is it within these individuals that encouraged them to hold so fast, to be so desperate, and to act out so viciously in an attempt to stop change.
Well, it sounds like, actually, in a kind of ironic way, it's change that they're asking for. But it's a change they can't have, not because we're trying to deny them, is that we can't go back. We've passed points in the evolution of our society, and we can't back up. We can't go back to white supremacy. I mean, it's very comfortable for people. They feel secure in it, but it's not good for the whole. And so rather than focus on the negative, they say, it's an opportunity for us to take seriously and research and interview and talk to people who come from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sister Joan also points out that most people don't take such public risk. So the public intellectual takes a lot of risk, and most of us aren't likely to risk being humiliated by speaking out. And so often that's the case with the public intellect, is that they're unencumbered, they're not frightened, they are aggressive about speaking out regarding issues of justice. And so you have to, I guess, in order to be a public intellectual, it takes a great deal of courage.
Well, and you don't have to have courage mastered to do it. I mean, you want to work on your courage. But my hunch is that often people who emerge as public intellectuals takes place because they're willing to expose themselves in order to raise a voice, or in order to contribute to this institution that they're part of.
That leads us into Joan's third clip about the seventh characteristic of the public intellectual and how they can serve to strengthen both the quality and the character of a just democracy. So let's listen.
Number seven, public intellectuals test the maturity of our faith and our spiritual elasticity. These writers and speakers, these thinkers and idea agents, wander into the mass of religious absolutes, and they bring out the questions that the theologians have to answer. These people risk more than most, because these people risk the institutional damnation of their own souls, the loss of one dimension of life that sustains them, and they lose their institutional faith community. And why? Because they have had the audacity to suggest that a new version of the Book of Prayer could possibly be printed and even sold. Dear friends, in too many faith communities, new ideas don't even get discussed, let alone recognized. Questions don't get pursued, at least not in the lifetime of the questioners. No, in these faith communities, the call to faith, when they tell you have faith, that's always a call for silence. That's code for don't talk about it. So much for the Holy Spirit. It is the ultimate response to the intimately essential question that leaves faith communities in schism for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I really was drawn to Joan's statement. She said, dear friends, in too many faith communities, new ideas don't even get discussed, let alone recognized. Questions don't get pursued, at least not in the lifetime of the questioners. No, in these faith communities, the call to faith, when they tell you, have faith, that's always a call for silence. That's code words for don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you rightly pointed out, people that don't want it talked about are people who have an investment in keeping things exactly as they are.
Mm-hmm. I was particularly interested when she mentioned the audacity to suggest that a new version of the Book of Common Prayer could possibly be printed or even sold. You know, as an Episcopalian ordained, you know, the Book of Common Prayer I realized when we moved to Mississippi from Colorado that the most recent Book of Common Prayer, that version that we use in the Episcopal Church today, dates to 1979. And I know other traditions, like the Methodist tradition, has their Book of Common Prayer. But we're using a Book of Common Prayer from 1979. However, in 1997, the National Church approved an alternative Book of Common Prayer that's called Enriching Our Worship. And when I was first ordained, we used this alternative worship because it spoke to the time. It is written with inclusive language, which means that it's not gender specific. So when you speak of God, it doesn't refer to God in the masculine, nor does it refer to God in the feminine. It refers to God as God. So, for example, let's take the Lord's Prayer. Instead of saying, Father who art in heaven, it says, God who art in heaven. It's hardly noticeable. And if people would just begin to insert that inclusive pronoun in place of an exclusive pronoun, I think that would have a tremendous impact on individuals' lives, both male and female.
Well, yeah, and for people who have not experienced exposure to the kinds of literature and the kinds of speakers that we're talking about, there's a reason, and they're not comfortable there. They don't know these people. The suspicion is that these people want to come in and take something precious away from us. And the public intellectuals, I'm making the same point again, and I apologize for
that.
But we public intellectuals, and that sounds like I'm being egotistical. If you knew how small I thought a public intellectual I am. I mean, but I'm hanging on with my fingers to the side of the boat because they've captured my attention. Mm-hmm. And they help me understand and analyze and objectify reality. So rather than talk about what we're afraid of, let's talk about what we're afraid of that's real. Mm-hmm. What is really at stake? And we better be pretty persuasive car salesmen, because people resist going into a change that they don't understand and don't know what's going to be on the other side of the door.
Right. Yeah, I was reminded of Joan's previous clip when she mentions Gloria Steinem and Jane Goodall, or Rachel Carson, James Hansen, and she talks about how they started off being ignored and rejected and abused. So in order to be able to take something as simple as the use of an alternative worship service, it met with such resistance. But it takes people to be daring to push for these changes, because they're healthy and everyone benefits from these types of changes. I applaud the public intellectual. So I want to go ahead and move into the fourth audio clip.
Okay.
All right.
Finally, public intellectuals make the implications of both exclusionism and pluralism plain. This is that they bring the tension between the obligations of conscience formation and the institutionalization of the civic religion looming large in our faces. What's the point? The point is, it's time for the presence and recognition of public intellectuals everywhere. We cannot be put in a situation where people tell us we're not allowed to listen to so-and-so, that they are not on the church's acceptable list or the country's list of exception. We have to raise our voices to call these systems to become their best selves. We must resist their decline if we're really to be worthy populations of just political systems. we need to encourage and to make a regular part of our public conversations those suppliers of ideas whose thoughts are fresh, whose insights are free, whose thinkers are committed to the furtherance. They're not out to destroy us.
In Jones' eighth public intellectual characteristic, she concludes with, "We have to raise our voices to call these systems to become their best selves."
Mm-hmm.
So one role the public intellectual can take, and let's talk about a church like a parish,
mm-hmm.
is to be willing in that parish to relentlessly call that parish to its best self. In other words, don't sit in the congregation and say, "Oh, I wish they wouldn't say that," or "I wish," if it's something important, then go to the person that you're thinking of and see if you can find a communication with them, rather than just sit there and absorb it and feel negative about it. So I think I'm going to go on a limb here, very, very short limb.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we experienced in the 2016 election was we were shocked that that went the way that it did. And we shouldn't have been. We should have been ready for this. We mm-hmm. should have seen. We knew enough about the former president. That sticks in my throat to even say that.
Mm-hmm.
We knew enough about this guy before the election, but we were asleep at the wheel. We just didn't do the work. And I don't mean to denigrate the people that exhausted themselves in that campaign. But my point is, we got sort of what we ask for
mm-hmm.
when we don't take responsibility for public thinking, and we don't take responsibility to speak up where there's a situation that's desperate for someone to speak up for.
Well, it reminds me again of this issue that's so important, that we've been struggling with this issue for decades, and that is public education.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to find out, when did we stop adequately funding public education?
I don't know the year, but I know the moment in history. It's when the desegregation orders came down from the Supreme Court. And people,
that would have been the 60s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, even 50s, where these things were beginning to be challenged. And you saw it acted out on campuses across America, where students were experiencing their world opening up and seeing a world that they didn't see in their childhood, in their early childhood. And you're wanting them to learn how to think critically and research and pay attention, and then to be involved in the collective. And I think even those of us that don't regard ourselves as the me generation,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to think of me that way. But the truth is that we were affected by the last 40 years of this whole concentration on me, how I feel, my health, my anxiety. So we focused so much of our energy on ourselves that it let us miss the opportunity to address issues that we needed to address.
And what about this concept of my personal Jesus, my personal relationship with Jesus?
Oh, don't get me started.
Yeah, I want you to talk about this. Let's talk about this. What is the impact of that concept instead of a Jesus that is of the community? So let's address that. I want to talk about this idea of this personal, private relationship with Jesus. Every individual, it's my relationship with Jesus. It's about me. And, you know, that's concerning. And what is the impact of that?
It's concerning, but if you're going to place it in some kind of framework that fits into history in terms of what actually happened, when when the different reformations of the church shook Europe, part of what they immediately latched on to, you know, Martin Luther's clarion call was for the priesthood of all believers, because one of the common experiences was that individuals in Europe who were part, you know, they were part of a parish, they felt they could not read the Bible, they had to go through some intermediary, and so this idea of everyone a priest of his or her own faith really took hold. The Protestant Reformation gave people the sense that they could have a relationship with God on their own terms, that they did not have to depend on an intermediary, on a priest or a bishop or whatever, but that they could have an intimate relationship with Jesus. There's really nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all.
If it doesn't make you cycle downward into your own needs. Mm-hmm. There are a lot, this is in the white church. Now, this is not, the white church and the black church are two different phenomena in this country. In the black church, they took this idea of personal relationship, and that got processed through their longing to be free. And so in their lives, the church was continually raising issues of justice and liberation and even helping people cope, and it was hell to cope with that system. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Jim Crow.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, what we end up with in the last 30 to 40 years is people becoming more than ever totally focused on whether or not they would be saved when they died. Would they be taken into heaven and all of, you know, all the permutations of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't need to beat on people about it, but where you end up is that your personal salvation, your concern about where you're going after you die, overshadows everything else. It overshadows the people in your family. It overshadows your participation as a citizen in the society, and it distorts or covers up, so we can't see it, the things that we depend upon that are solid. One last thing. Because the church, the white church in the West especially, has been so focused on salvation until it ends up making my faith all about me and what's mm-hmm. going to happen to mm-hmm. me. And we really need to turn a corner so that our faith pushes us toward caring about the common good. What's it like for everyone mm-hmm. that's in this democracy? And what do they need to have and to know and so forth, in order for them to survive, not at a subsistence level, but as a reasonable living wage level. Anyway.
Well, in summary, it seems to me like if we look back at our history, that public intellectuals always emerged when the country was sharply divided. Mm-hmm. And it was during the Civil War, during Vietnam War, the fights for civil rights and women's rights. And this moment of deep ideological division will likely see the return, right when we need them, of the thinkers and talkers who can bridge the emotional divide. And I think Joan makes that point mm-hmm. very well in this lecture.
I agree.
Well, David, thank you. Thank you to our listening audience. We, again, would love to hear from you, so please consider leaving a comment at the bottom of the page of this featured podcast online. And Faith and Reason 360 podcasts are produced by the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation and spiritual educational audio materials are available online. Visit our website at www.faithandreason.org. Additional funding is provided by the Winland Cook Foundation.